You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
While you were skipping stones, building forts, and flying kites, I was missing school and all my Saturday nights. Other kids were climbing trees and rolling down hills. I was singing songs to pay my family's bills. Little me, growing up Broadway. Little me.
Hello, I'm Mark Tuminelli, and welcome back to the Little Me Podcast. If you're not following our little Instagram, stop everything and go give us a follow at Little Me Podcast. My guest today is a recording artist and an actor who made his Broadway debut at age 11 as Colin in The Secret Garden. He also appeared on Broadway in Wicked and Xanadu. In 1992, he was named Ed McMahon's Junior Vocalist Star Search Champion, beating a then-unknown Britney Spears. We'll do a deep dive on that for sure. His off-Broadway credits include My Big Gay Italian Wedding, Pageant, and Loss of Roses. He was featured in the film The Big Gay Musical. He played Damon on Two Broke Girls and Charlie on Grace and Frankie. He's a vocal arranger, producer, and a backup vocalist who has sung with stars like Billy Porter, Grace Jones, Patti LaBelle, Jennifer Holliday, Stephanie Mills, my girl Debbie Gibson, Barry Manilow, and many more. His latest album, Slow Dancing with a Boy, was released to Broadway Records this past December. I'm so excited to welcome Mr. Show Business himself, Marty Thomas.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Marty. How are you?
I'm so good.
My God, thank you so much for doing this. I'm so excited to talk to you. You've had such a long, incredible, diverse career doing so many things in the industry. And I think your story is so incredibly interesting. So thank you for being here.
Oh, that's so nice of you. Thank you for having me.
Always. All right, let's start. Let's talk about your album, which was released in December. It's called Slow Dancing with the Boy. Tell me the story. How did it come about? How did you put together that collection of songs? It's a beautiful, brilliant album.
Thank you. It's a very personal project. It all started with a little bit of heartbreak, as many projects do. I happened upon a HuffPost style article that was very clickbaity, that was essentially Boy Goes to Prom. And there was a picture of a boy with another boy going to prom, which for me and my age group and my generation, that's an anomaly.
Unheard of.
Kind of unheard of. Not completely, but safely growing up in a small Midwest farm town, it was unheard of. So I clicked the link, and somewhere in my heart and mind, I expected to see the article be about these beautiful boys getting beaten senselessly and getting hurt, and it being a very sad article. And I just sort of like bit the stick and clicked the link to read it and see if they were okay. And I was so confused because I'm seeing this collection of photos of these boys at the top of the stairs, like an 80s makeover montage movie. And their parents are taking pictures of them. And they're proud of this moment of these boys going to prom together and having this normal coming of age moment. And then there was a picture of them at the prom, and their friends were just dancing around them, not staring at them, not keeping 10 feet apart, making sure it's okay. There was no question that it was just a boy on a date. And I kept reading, and he won prom king, and he had such a beautiful experience that had no backlash, and he wasn't worried about how it was being interpreted. And I would love to think of myself as somebody who would think that was so beautiful and cool and progress. And I found myself so bitter and angry about it. Not that this kid had had this honest moment, but that I never realized that I felt robbed of that coming of age moment and those basic moments that people are afforded as the human experience, that I somehow, with growing up in a religious background, growing up in a farm town, had convinced myself that I wasn't worthy of and I wasn't valid, and that those kids, those straight kids, deserved that moment, and I somehow deserved to stay hidden away. Which, you know, then manifested itself and it marinated and it turned into, well, how many moments have I squandered in my life because I didn't feel like I was valid or worthy? And how did that manifest itself in me manipulating the truth and lying and telling half truths and convincing myself and other people that I was more than I was because I didn't feel enough based on a childhood of feeling not enough.
Enough.
that religion and family and whatever had told me was the truth. And I started, it just stayed with me for months and months and months. And every time I would hear a song come on the radio, the kind of song that takes you back to high school or college, or those moments, those school dances or camp, a song would come on and it would just stab me. It would take me to seeing those two boys having that moment. And I would replay all the times in my childhood and adolescence that I didn't participate in my own life.
Did you feel like making the album and putting the songs out and sharing them has healed that a little bit for you?
I mean, I'd love to say 100%. That was the goal, that I took all of these songs that kept popping up in my life that were moments from school dances or moments from my childhood that all had very specific meaning, and kind of turned them on their ear and rearranged them in an effort to pull them back into the light, to love those songs again, rather than them being a stab of pain. I wanted them to be joyful again. So I took I took Mariah Carey's Dream Lover, which was a really big song my junior year in high school. And I arranged it as a country two-step with Rachel Potter and Jamie Ray.
So good.
Thank you. Yeah. That it was kind of an homage to a dance that my school had called the barn warming, which in creative
actually sounds like a nightmare. Sorry.
It was a nightmare. It was in this place called the Rock Barn, which was a barn made of rock. And it was horrible. It was like the school dance where you knew people were going to fight and you knew people were going to be drinking in the parking lot. And it was just awful. But of course I went. And in putting this together and talking to people about this project and talking to people about all the school dances that we had, I realized my school had like 9 times the school dances that anybody else had.
Yeah, I think my school had like 2 a year. It was like
we had
maybe
so
a fall
many.
And a spring thing. That was it.
We had yearbook dance and homecoming dance and barn warming dance and of course prom. And then we would have like a Sadie Hawkins.
Yeah.
It felt like we had a new dance every month in the gym.
I'm obsessed with your cover of Crazy for You, Madonna's song. It is my favorite thing on the album. You sound incredible on it, but there's something that is so rich about it and it feels very personal. So I was wondering if you have, what's your connection to that song?
I mean, I was a gay child living in the 80s. So my connection is
so much like my own.
It's very purely Madonna.
Yes.
Madonna, Madonna, Madonna. And all of her music was like so omnipresent in the life of any child or teenager in the 80s.
Yeah.
So that was one song that I had always found so romantic. And when I did a duet with Michael Kilgore that I had arranged of a Vanessa Williams song, Save the Best for Last, with a Bryan Adams song that was huge when I was in middle school from the Robin Hood soundtrack, Everything I Do It For You. So I mashed the two songs up because they were these really powerful songs my 7th grade summer. And I had gone to this music camp and there was this boy that I was just had a huge crush on, but didn't understand it. And I think as a gay kid in the Midwest, you know that if you talk to each other, people are going to be on to you. So you avoid each other like the plague, but you just connect and stare and catch eyes. And there was a dance at the end of the week that I just kept seeing moments that I would like try to play it out in my head, that the dance floor would sort of create a path and just walk up to him and talk to him and just say hi. And I never took the opportunity.
You'll feel it in my kiss because I'm crazy for you. Touch me once and you'll know it's true. I never wanted anyone like this. It's all brand new. You'll feel it in my kiss. I'm crazy for you.
You mentioned Michael Kilgore. There's a lot of amazing people on your album. There's so much backup singing. It does feel very theatrical in its sense that it feels bigger than just one person in a microphone. How did you decide who you wanted to include on the album? I know that you've worked with, you know, amazing, incredible singers. How does then Marty Thomas decide, okay, these are my people who are doing this with me?
The album sort of just, it was a long process. It was a multi-year project of figuring out what this project actually was and what it was going to be. From inception to final product, it changed dramatically and became more and more personal as it developed. My best friend, Jamie Ray, produced the album. And Jamie Ray is the arranger and one of the vocalists with the super famous a cappella group Voctive. So he is, that is his specialty, is a cappella arrangements and vocals. And I love choral arrangements. So Jamie and I have always really clicked in our love for that sound. When we were choosing the material and coming up with the arrangements, everything just sort of started happening organically. We recorded the album in Orlando at Rollins University, where Jamie is a professor. And so we found, we used a lot of crazy talented Orlando vocalists in the choir. And it, a lot of it times it just was who's available this day. And it just kept happening that the, my favorite singers in the country just happened to be around and not doing anything that day. And we, Rachel, my Potter, Jamie and I's ride or die bestie, Broadway star.
It's so talented.
So talented.
That recording of her singing Another Suitcase, Another Hall is, I've listened to it like a thousand times.
There's a fascinating story behind that that I should tell you at some point about her, how she booked that role. But it was just, you know, when you're really close with somebody, as you are with so many Broadway performers, when you get to see that, like, that journey and that success story, it's just magic because you get to see how it happened in a way that nobody else does, you know?
Yeah.
So Rachel flew in that we had intended that she was going to do the Dream Lover arrangement that I had written for with Jamie and Rachel that I had written for the three of us. And she was there on a day we were recording vocals. So we got her on all of the super high soprano. It's wild, the range that she has. She was doing whistle tone things in my arrangement of Somewhere. She was singing first soprano down to first alto all over the page because she's so diverse and unique. Tiffany Coburn is a singer on the record. She is essentially Sandy Patty's vocal double.
Okay.
She is the woman that they call to warm up an audience for Sandy Patty, and she's always covering that. And a lot of the singers from Voctive, just amazing vocalists. And of course, when I wrote the seventh grade arrangement, I wrote it with Michael in mind. And I reached out and asked him if it was an opportunity, if there was going to be an opportunity with his busy schedule to get him into the studio. And I thought, I'll record his vocals in New York. And he said, where are you recording the album? And I said, Orlando. And he was like, I'm going to Orlando tomorrow. He's from there. So,
oh my God, so perfect.
I know, it was literally that meant to be. And I wasn't in the studio when he recorded it. I was on Skype and Jamie was, you know, directing it and producing it. But I think the record sounds so organic.
Oh, it sounds like you guys are in the same room. It's so, you could hear the connection between you two. It's really gorgeous, Marty. Congratulations. I hope everyone listening here will download it, pay full price, because it is, it's really dynamic. It does not, it feels like such a labor of love. And I've so enjoyed listening to it. And I know people are loving it. So congratulations. It's so cool.
Thanks a lot, Mark. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. All right. I want to go back to the beginning because we talk about being child stars here at the Little Me Podcast, and you have such an interesting, incredible story. So let's go back to the beginning. You grew up in Missouri.
I did. Town called Trenton.
All right. I don't know where it is. I worked at the Arrow Rock Lyceum Theater in 2002. I don't know.
Arrow Rock is kind of on the east of the state.
Okay.
And we're directly across from Arrow Rock on the west corner, kind of right by Iowa and Kansas, in Grundy County, the number one methamphetamine producing county.
Oh my God, how nice.
In the world.
Well, you know, it's really nice to be from a town that is famous for something.
Listen, did you see the documentary on Netflix, The Act?
No. Oh, wait, is that the one with the mother, like...
Yeah, the wackadoodle in the wheelchair.
Yeah, yeah.
The girl is in prison across from my high school.
Great.
So we're also famous for super classy things.
Oh, her name's Gypsy Rose Blanchard.
Yeah, that's it.
Yes. I'm obsessed with true crime. So I'm got you. All right. So you're in Missouri. Where, how does New York, Broadway, Hollywood, how does that start for you?
I started singing in church, which I grew up in a Southern Baptist church, very, very like a movie. I remember we got indoor plumbing when I was like 8 or 9 at the church.
Let's remind people you are not in your 70s. This was like,
I'm not.
This is 1986 or something.
Yeah, 1988, they got, I seem to believe that was the summer they got indoor plumbing. And it's just so country with no money and a farming community out in the middle of nowhere, literally the middle of nowhere. And there was an outhouse and there was music. We didn't have a great sound system. There was just music. There was always so much music. And it was really celebrated to perform and to lift up your voice. Within the church. So I started singing so young, singing songs from Bible school. And of course I was raised on very, very religious music, but also country Western. And then every weekend, if you put tinfoil on the antenna of a radio and you put it right in the corner of a basement on a shelf, you could get a disco station out of Kansas City on the weekends. And again, this is not 900 years ago. It was not that long ago. We were just country. So I had like a really big love for that gospel styling of dance music. And then country music is my base. And of course, gospel and contemporary Christian music was a big influence. People within my church would find opportunities in the paper and send them my way. I started auditioning for a large regional theater in Kansas City called Starlight Theater.
Oh, I've been there.
Yeah, I would do summer theater there as a kid and honestly made connections there at 7, 8 years old that are still business connections.
And Starlight Theater is like a huge outdoor theater. It's like it's a smaller Muni, but it's very similar in
it's
scale.
Same size.
It's the same Muni. Size?
Yeah, they're like a sister theater to Muni. Yeah. And, you know, Kansas City was 2.5 hours from where we lived. So it was a huge sacrifice for my mom to take me to rehearse every day. You know, it was like 3 weeks a summer.
Yeah.
You'd rehearse every day and then you'd do the shows for a week. And one summer I got cast in Annie. And the girl who was playing Annie, her name was Danielle Finley. She went on to play Annie in Annie 2. The revival that almost came to Broadway. But Annie had done Broadway before and she was so connected in New York. And she introduced me to her New York agent, Nancy Carson, who I signed with from Missouri. And she called my parents and told them she had some auditioning opportunities for me in New York. And my dad, after enough phone calls and poking and prodding, he sucked it up and spent money he did not have to take my brother and my mom and I to New York for our first like real family vacation out of state. And we came to New York and he gave me a voice lesson with Robert Marks.
I know exactly where this is going.
And it was just like, it was such a pivotal weekend because I mean, I remember walking up to Robert's door and my dad gave me $100 bill to pay him for this. And every time I talk about it, I start tearing up because I remember that day I was just beside myself. Because you just, growing up country, you just know how hard it is to make $100 and how far a country family can stretch a $100 bill. You know, they can live on that for a month so easily. And remembering my dad giving me that $100 bill to take a voice lesson, my first voice lesson with Robert, who essentially taught me how to audition in an hour. And from that audition, we went to start our chain of Broadway calls. And by the end of the day, I was cast in Secret Garden and my mom and I moved to New York about a week later.
Okay, that's insane. What do you remember about that audition?
I remember they were asking me to try to emulate an English accent. And I said, well, I speak English. And they were like, not exactly what we mean. And I had such a country accent. I'm sure that it was even thicker than hell back then. Just so country. And I remember Janine Tesori was playing my audition, which is hilarious as well. And, you know, all of these incredibly important theatrical legends were in the room, but they meant nothing to us because we didn't even know what Broadway was.
Had you not seen a Broadway show yet?
I had never left Missouri.
No, but I mean on that trip.
That was our first day.
Yeah. So you, oh my God, the first day you go to Rob Marks and you go right to your audition.
Yep. we flew in that night. We went to sleep. We woke up the next morning and went to Robert Marks, then went on a series of auditions. And I was, again, so country that I, at the end of the audition, it was such a thing that you do as a kid because you don't know any better. My mom, as they walked us to, we were at the St. James Theater and singing on stage, which doesn't happen anymore. And after the audition, my mom said, "Do you have any idea when you'd let us know one way or the other?" And they were like, "Well, now, we'd like you to start rehearsing next week." And I remember the whole family was like, "What? How do we do that?" And, they had me try to emulate, they'd have somebody speak in an English. Barbara Rosenblatt was the vocal coach, mm-hmm. Dialect coach.
And she comes up on this podcast so often.
She's the connector.
Yeah.
Honestly, she was, such a kind woman. She was always introducing me to things. I remember she bought me a can of Ovaltine because I didn't know what it was. And she kept talking about Ovaltine. And I guess it's just a city thing that country kids don't have. Things like that. She would introduce me to New York delicacies. But she would speak in the accent and ask me to replicate it. And then they were asking me to sing from the score. And I'd been taking piano since I was born, so I could sight read, which is very unusual for a kid that age back then.
Yeah.
And, back then it was just a different world. There was no online. There was no mass cattle calls. Child actors weren't really, you didn't see them on TV. You didn't see them, the process. So not as many people found the opportunity for their kids to perform as now.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's just a wealth of opportunity.
Oh my God, it's overwhelming.
It's overwhelming. But back then, honestly, in the country, there was a handful of little boy performers who could sing, read music, who had any acting experience, who could move a little. So it was just right time, right place, opportunity struck.
And you started rehearsals the next week and you and your mom moved to New York?
We did. We moved and started rehearsal again the day after we moved here. I was living in the Strand on 43rd and 10th.
Yeah.
I now live across the street. I went to the Professional Performing Arts School, which I'm sure you've heard that word a lot in your life. And I discovered so much music and I was immersed in a completely different world.
How did your mom do with that enormous transition?
I think my mom thrived. My mom and I butt heads on politics and religion and so many base fundamental values, but what we do share is a sense of adventure. My mom loved New York. She got a job at a place called Mamma Leone's, which was an Italian restaurant right above Phantom of the Opera, like that corner building, that corner that's like a gift shop now and a hotel. On the second floor, it was this really famous Italian restaurant called Mamma Leone's. And she got a job answering phones. And they kept saying, "We'd like you to say buongiorno, this is Carol." And she'd say, "Buongiorno, this is Carol, can I help you?" She got demoted very quickly to being a hostess at the restaurant. And she loved it. And she worked at the Embassy Suites Hotel, which was a hotel on Times Square right by the Palace, mm-hmm. or above the Palace Theater, really. And she would work in, they called it the Cool Cat Kids Club. It was like a Garfield-themed daycare. So she just had all these jobs while I was in school.
She would just drop you off at the theater and go to work and go to school. Tell me about your starting performances. So you were an early replacement in the show. Mm-hmm. And so tell me about that first time you went on. What do you remember?
Nothing. I just don't remember it. I remember getting a lot of really beautiful gifts and thinking, cannot believe people spent so much money on flowers, and just couldn't fathom the attention. And I just didn't think it was that big a deal. I didn't get it. I didn't understand what I was doing, which was good because otherwise I would have been stressed out.
Yeah. And it probably felt fun to you that you were getting to perform with all these incredible adults in this beautiful show.
And I didn't know who they were. So, Howard McGillin and Daisy Egan and John Cameron Mitchell and Alison Fraser and Barbara Rosenblatt and they were just nice people. Rebecca Luker,
It's incredible. Do you remember the first time you saw the show before you went in?
I did. I didn't see the show until I had already been offered it, the role. Yeah. We saw it that night after I offered it. They offered it, and I had just, it blew my mind, because who knew that theater could be so lavish and could be so colorful and exciting and gorgeous. Just every second of it was a masterpiece, that original production.
And I was saying, when Daisy Egan was on the podcast, we talked a lot about it being people of our generation, the first time they saw maybe a dark musical, it had been, you really didn't go with your kids, didn't really go see Les Mis. And so it was, anything you saw was very family friendly or an old school musical, like an Oklahoma or a Music Man. People weren't seeing like dark, interesting musicals. So it sort of opened up this sort of box of young theater fans that felt like they could connect to a musical that felt interesting and introspective and had ghosts, and it had feelings that were beyond being cute and charming and charming and smiley.
So I've really never thought about it like that. I think you're right. No, that now that you say it out loud, I've never heard it worded quite like that.
Well, anytime. I'm happy to share all my thoughts on The Secret Garden, because I think it's like the most perfect musical, and we desperately should have a revival of that show.
I went to see the Lincoln Center revival, and it was beautiful, a gorgeous cast, but what it made me realize is the ending is very flawed.
They're just like, everything's fine.
Right. That it was like dark, 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 climbing up the mountain. This is so hard. This is so hard. And boom, we're done. And I didn't remember it being like that. I remembered it being more poignant and more round. I just felt like it really rounded the corner a little more strongly than it actually does. The show is just so gorgeous and so perfect, and the ending is what it should be. It's just the transition.
It just happens too quickly.
It happens so fast that they tie it up with a bow.
You know, that happens every once in a while on Broadway. Were you auditioning for other Broadway shows and things while you were doing Secret Garden, since you were now living in New York, going to PPAS?
I think so. I do remember going to a lot of commercial auditions, and I remember being in the final calls for Home Alone and for Radio Flyer and a lot of kid movies that I was just very close to. I remember auditioning for a lot of pilots. I sang a lot. I sang everywhere. Brittany and I used to sing just anywhere they'd let us. And there was a space where they did the original pageant, mm-hmm. right by where Birdland is, called the Blue something or other. And they had a big open dance floor that I remember doing shows there at 11, I guess, 11 and 12 years old, that we would just do a cabaret to karaoke tracks.
Oh my God. Where is that video?
You know, we didn't take video.
I know. No one did.
Back then, because everything was, you experienced it and you walked away, and there was no social media. We didn't even take as many pictures then. I don't have a lot of documentation of that window of my life.
Yeah. How long did you stay in the show?
About a year.
Okay. And then how did Star Search come out? Did it come out during that time?
Came out during it. It had actually started before it. I was doing a show at that same theater. I was doing The Wizard of Oz the summer after I did Annie. And I had been sending in tapes to Star Search my entire childhood. And they called me while I was doing that show and were like, can you fly to LA right now, essentially? And it was just, I couldn't. I was under contract with Starlight, and it was heartbreaking. So the casting offices were in New York City, even though they filmed in LA. And my mom, when we got to New York, one of the first days I went to school, she took the day to find the office and go talk to them and drop off a cassette and say, he's here and he's available. So I got a call one day that they wanted me to fly to LA to compete as like kind of a last minute fill in for somebody who had dropped out or something. And I thought I was being punked by my brother. So I hung up on them several times, just kept hanging up. And finally they were like, I'm not going to call you again. I'm kind of thing. And just a few weeks later, I took a weekend off from the garden. And I remember Allison Fraser and John Cameron and everybody was helping me pick music and kind of encouraging me. We flew out for the weekend and I did my first episode, and that's kind of how it worked.
What did you sing on that first episode?
I sang a song called The Time Is Now that was an original song by my my vocal teacher at PPAS, Aziza Miller, who I'm still in contact with. And Brittany had sung Love Can Build a Bridge by the Judds.
Yes. It is an epic performance from both of you. Everyone should watch that on YouTube immediately.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Was there a level of stress that you were feeling like that your mom, your dad, your family was making all of these opportunities happening for you that you had to deliver, that you had to win?
Maybe at first. But overall, no. Because everything was just sort of happening and sort of unfolding. I do remember when I was, when my contract wasn't renewed at the Secret Garden, because I was getting too big for the role, I definitely felt like I had let everyone down and it was heartbreaking.
So you do Star Search, you win Star Search, you have to go back to Secret Garden, obviously, because you just took weekends off to do that. Yes.
Yeah.
And what was that experience like going back into the show after having this other big sort of TV experience? And the whole world watched Star Search. It was such a big deal.
The way Star Search was filmed was it didn't air for 5 or 6 months mm-hmm. after you filmed it. So you kind of had to keep it tight what happened, but it wasn't like keeping it tight now. Like now you sign NDAs. Back then it was like,
just don't tell anyone.
Please don't tell anyone. And if you do tell anyone, they probably don't matter. But try not to. Now it's like heavy duty. If we see it in print, you're disqualified. It's just a very different world now. That coming back, I mean, of course, the cast was celebrating me and being awesome and so super supportive. So I just felt like a big, big deal. And I felt like a star. And I think I probably let it go to my head a lot.
Tell me about Britney Spears. When did you first meet her?
Star Search.
Yeah.
I mean, we knew of each other, but we first really got to talk and become friends on Star Search. And our parents became really close.
Because you were kind of both doing the same thing. You're kind of country kids that were making it work in New York because that's the same time she was doing Ruthless.
She wasn't doing Ruthless yet. She, after Star Search, she and her mother moved to New York and we were very tight that they stayed with us for a while when they first came to the city. Uh-huh. And after I left the city, anytime we'd come back for an audition or for an opportunity, we'd stay with Brittany and her mom, Lynn. And we just had so much in common because we were country and had similar upbringings. And like you said, we were doing the same thing and we would share music. We would share opportunities and auditions and it was just awesome to have a friend who was as motivated and as interested in what we were doing as I was.
So it was probably not a surprise to see what she like by 1997 or 98, you know, all anyone was talking about was Britney Spears. Like
there's nothing that can prepare you for your friend or family member becoming what Britney Spears is today. And I remember the summer before it came out, her dad had sent me like the original cassette demo of, Baby One More Time before it was way before it was released. And they were using, he and other people in the biz were using words like, she's going to be bigger than Michael Jackson. We were like, yeah, right. Fun. Good story. Tell it like it is, Mother Goose.
So you did Cedar Garden until you outgrew it. And then did you guys have to go back home? Was that?
Yeah. What? Yeah. We stayed in New York for a little while, but you know, we didn't have the budget to just stay there without an opportunity. And when you're leaving a show as a child actor, especially as a boy, you're entering a world of voice change.
Yeah.
And my voice never really cracked and dropped. It just, I lost all control and I lost my range. I just couldn't figure out how to navigate the upper range and the lower register in a way that I had been able to as a kid. And I'm blessed that I was encouraged by my family and my church to keep singing through it. And they were really supportive of the journey of learning. And I think that if I had stopped singing, as many kids do, because they don't understand how to navigate it, it probably would have gone away and my voice probably would have dropped. But somehow my register and my palate stayed really high.
So how hard is it for you to go back to regular school kind of in the country after having this big city experience? Were kids horrible to you? Were they were like, did they want to know everything about it?
It was a little bit of both. It was horrible. It was the worst year of my life for sure. Because it ranged from people being so intrigued and impressed with what I had done and wanting to know about the experiences to people being so turned off and, you know, just finding me, if I did talk about it, I was bragging. If I didn't talk about it, I was stuck up. I was, and I'm sure I had an inflated view of myself and I'm sure I made a million mistakes, but neither here nor there, it was the worst year of my life.
And what grade was that?
Seventh, eighth.
And Star Search had aired already.
Mm-hmm.
And so everyone kind of had seen that.
Yes.
Was there an initial, were there so many people that would walk up to you or see you and be like, I watch you on Star Search. Was that happening when that?
You know, no, because in my hometown, it's like, you know, people would say that, but you know everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see anybody that you don't know there, you know?
Yeah. So they all know the story.
They all know exactly what's happening. And the local paper is called the Trenton Republican Times.
Ooh.
It's about 10 pages. And so you're on the cover if you breathe. It's really easy to get a news story there. And they were always incredibly supportive of me from the time I was a little boy until now. Anytime I do anything of note, it's the local radio and local paper calling to interview and write about it. It's kind. It's cool.
Did you do your high school musicals? Did they do musicals?
Yeah. We didn't have a theater department. We just didn't have arts.
So how do you get through this next 4 years before you can really, are you coming back and forth to New York? Are there auditions that come up?
I am coming back and forth to New York, but for probably 2 years, I really just spent the time navigating, figuring out how to sing again.
Mm-hmm.
And I really dug into country music, which took me to Branson, Missouri, which is kind of the country music capital of the Midwest, where it looks like Las Vegas, where older country stars kind of ride out their twilight years singing, doing these large production style shows. And I sang with Johnny Cash and Glenn Campbell and the Presley's Jubilee. And I did a show called The Young Branson Stars and Young Country, and cut my teeth on guitar and accompanying myself and singing with a band and singing backup vocals and arranging backup vocals.
Which has been the trajectory of all of this incredible work that you've done. Like, we learned so much in those years that people don't realize are going to have such a big effect on a career.
Huge effect. The things you fall in love with out of necessity, because that was what was available to me. I dug so deep into country music, and I just love country style. And it's, again, I feel like that's why Rachel Potter and I became such close friends when we first met. And there have been so many people in my adult life that moments circle back to Branson. I did a show, I did Cast Party with Jim Caruso last week,
mm-hmm.
and he brought on Pam Tillis, which if you know country music, you know Pam Tillis as Mel Tillis's daughter, and she's one of the greatest singer-songwriters in the country, you know, anthology. And some her album, Spilled Perfume, is one of my all-time favorite albums. So he let me chat with her online, and I got to ask her a bunch of questions, and it's wild because he knows how much I love 90s country music.
So you were back on Broadway in Wicked. Did it feel so wild to be back doing a Broadway show again after doing all this choral work and having not done a Broadway show since you were a kid?
It was wild. When I first came to New York, I was singing in open mics everywhere. And I had released a gospel dance single on a disco label called West End Records that hadn't released a song in probably 20 years. And I toured internationally promoting that record in nightclubs and circuit parties and things, in every gay disco around the world. I sang that song and had a lot of success in the dance music industry, but the dance music industry sort of suffered after 9/11. Mm-hmm. And back to the drawing board of lined up with gigs. It was like 9/11 killed my gig calendar in the same way that COVID-19 has killed my gig calendar this year.
Well, you made it through that. You're making it through this.
So I started doing a weekly show at a club called XL on 16th Street.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
That Broadway performers would sing every Monday. And they gave me my own show after guesting on several people's shows. Jay Rodriguez gave me a lot of really great opportunities there before I had another Broadway adult contract. And I really cut my teeth on creating my own act and creating my own show and putting a band together as an adult and building my rep. And just through singing everywhere around town. And when I was a kid on Star Search, I was on Star Search with Billy Porter, who was such a mentor to me coming to the city and provided endless opportunities and introductions for me. And he had introduced me to his friend, Matt Zarley, a recording artist who was tight with Stephen Aremus, who was a budding music director then. And eventually Wicked needed a high tenor. And just like when I was a kid, there really weren't that many of us back then. Screaming high tenors wasn't the trend in the early 2000s like it is now. And I feel like the work that I was doing and that Billy was doing and a few of us kind of changed the trajectory of what a tenor is seen as today. Because there, you know, we were singing, Wicked was like, we're having a really tough time finding a tenor who can sustain B flats. Well, B flats are like home base for a tenor now. You have to have a B flat as a baritone now.
So you did Wicked for how long?
Like almost 4 years, I think.
And that was, you really joined that show like almost right in the beginning, right?
Yeah, right after it opened.
Yeah. And I'm sure it's so thrilling to be part of something that was so embraced by everyone. And
it was
being a hit show like that is like such a dream.
It was.
And then you followed that up. Your next Broadway show was Xanadu, which is one of my favorite things I've ever seen on Broadway. And that's how we sort of know each other, because you are our skating coach at Broadway Workshop for our production back in, I'm looking at the poster, 2013. Talk to me about working on Xanadu.
Xanadu was awesome. It was the whole experience was awesome. It was, I had done a Gypsy of the Year or Easter Bonnet skit for Wicked that I had come up with a concept of. It was when we were just started touring and other productions were opening and Wicked was becoming more of a branded
property.
Yeah, branded property. It was becoming huge. And at the time, Megan Hilty had joined as the Glinda standby, and Eden Espinoza had recently become the standby again for Elphaba. And so I had written this idea that Wicked has gone everywhere. What's next? Wicked on Ice. And so we rewrote the lyrics of Wizard and I to Wicked on Ice. And our costume department built this elaborate costume design of all of the Wicked costumes, but as ice skating uniforms. And they flooded the stage with smoke and we roller skated to do this reimagining of Wicked on Ice. And, Eden and Megan played the presidents of their own fan club singing about Wicked on Ice. And we, the number, I had done the skate coaching with Rob Sapp. And from that, a million people dropped my name to the casting director, which they brought us in. And we started as a reading, which days into the reading turned into a workshop. And it felt like, as I remember it, it felt like during the workshop, we were getting an off-Broadway run. And then shortly after the workshop, they had a Broadway theater.
And that was Jane Krakowski was originally part of the workshop. Is that right?
She was. She was Kira, and Cheyenne was Sunny. And an incredible cast in that reading. Darius DeHaas and Tyler Maynard, Jen Cody. And then, of course, the Jackie Hoffman and Mary Testa that really made that show.
God, brilliant. Just the greatest performances.
Truly, truly. And then when we transferred to Broadway, James Carpinello was our Sonny, and they had hired Carrie Butler as our Kira. And James had a horrible accident shortly into previews, and Cheyenne was really the only person who could have filled in for him on such short notice. And Cheyenne learned all of those changes in like 24 hours.
Wow.
And went on. And the audience just loved him. And the rest is history for that show. It was just, it was such a magical discovery working with the vision that they had behind that show.
Well, we have to like wrap up and do quick fire questions and obsess, but I have so many more things for you. Yeah, recently you've just been doing a bunch of TV stuff, doing Grace and Frankie, Two Broke Girls, which is I was obsessed with. But when you were a kid, you were on Unsolved Mysteries, which is like my favorite show. So tell me where I can find you on Unsolved Mysteries. This is just for me. I don't care if anyone's
listening. I don't know. I do have one like really bad videotape that I've been trying to transfer, but you know how video was back then. You just couldn't get good.
Well, every episode is on Amazon.
Is it?
Yes, all 13 seasons.
Well, I'll hunt for it because I know I did a lot of cult episodes. It was the year of Waco.
Ooh.
And cults were popping up everywhere. It was like cult was that year's COVID. Everybody was talking about cults. So they'd bring you out to a farm and they'd give you a backstory. And it was the funnest improv because there was no real script. You were doing like reenactment.
Yeah.
And somebody would be playing the crazy preacher and you'd be all sitting around like the crazy cult church members. And I just thought it was the funnest ever. It was my first experience with really solid craft services.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Love that NBC Universal, Unsolved Mysteries craft services.
You know it.
It's so exciting. Okay, Marty, what are you obsessed with right now?
Two things. I never in a million years would have gotten involved in either of these things before quarantine. But in quarantine, I discovered Real Housewives. Oh my gosh.
Favorite.
I have spent so many hours watching New Jersey, Beverly Hills, Dallas, New York, and Potomac. I'm obsessed.
What's your favorite?
I think Potomac and Beverly Hills are my favorites, but Dallas is amazing.
I just feel like nothing's better than New York, but we can fight it out.
New York is not my favorite.
All right.
I think Beverly Hills, they take more fabulous trips and they have more fabulous glam teams.
Glam teams, which so, you know, you also have your cosmetology license and
I'm so into the glam.
Every time I see anyone with like a great haircut, I'm like, oh, you look great. They're like Marty Thomas.
Ah, thank you.
So you can go to Marty for that as well.
Yeah, Marty Thomas hair on
you. You really do everything.
I'm a hustler from way back. I love Real Housewives. And we recently started from season one, episode one, because I had never seen it, Survivor.
Oh, so fun.
It's amazing. I had never seen it. I didn't know it was such a fun show. I started it last week and we're already on season six. And we're trying to get through 40 seasons before season 41 airs in February.
Well, luckily you never need to know what happened the season before really to watch the current one. So you'll be okay if you need to start season 40 or whatever in February.
There are so many, they leave out episodes on Hulu. They'll like, you can't watch.
So that you can buy it. You have to buy it. It's so rude.
You can't even buy the episode. You have to get a subscription to CBS to watch it.
I'm not okay with that. My obsession this week is so basic. It's Taylor Swift's current album, Folklore. I'm obsessed with it. I've never been obsessed with her. I cannot name one other song she sings, but that album is so good. I am so here for it. So between Marty's album and Taylor Swift's album, you are covered musically for the next couple weeks, friends. All right. Are you ready for the Broadway Workshop quickfire questions?
I woke up ready for this.
Okay. Favorite holiday?
Halloween.
First Broadway show you saw was also the first Broadway show you were in. Did you have braces?
No.
Tell me one thing about Mary Testa.
Gorgeous, naturally curly hair. I can't get enough of her hair.
First audition song.
Oh, What a Beautiful Morning.
Favorite song to sing right now?
Anything by Dua Lipa.
Singer you're most obsessed with?
Shoshana Bean.
Brilliant. If you can go back and do one performance of anything in your career, what would it be?
One performance in my career, if I could go back and do, that's a lot of years of performances. I would go back and do Star Search.
Yes. If you had a yacht, what would you call it?
If I had a yacht, what would I call it? I think I'm so basic, I would probably call it the boat.
I love it. Okay, do you remember your Wrangler's name on The Secret Garden?
Betsy.
Oh, very nice. What would your superhero power be?
Flying.
Most recent Broadway audition?
Most recent Broadway audition. Mark, I haven't auditioned in a long time.
All right, well, we'll make that happen after this is all over.
I did book a show. I was going to do a show. I was going to do Sideshow. Of course, it got canceled because of COVID. Rachel Potter and I were going to be doing it together.
As Daisy and Violet?
She was Daisy and I was the ringmaster.
Oh, very nice.
We were so excited.
I'd love to see your Daisy and Violet with her, if that's an option.
Can you imagine?
Okay, your favorite Elphaba.
Oh, gosh, why has it got to be so hard? Jessica Vosk.
She's brilliant. What do you want on your bagel?
All the cream cheese and lox and capers.
Pre-show ritual?
Pre-show ritual. I like to take a shower before a show. I do.
Strangest stage door interaction.
That could go a long way with Wicked. Strangest stage door. I mean, in the early days of Wicked, people would follow me home.
Oh, so weird.
So I think that's the strangest
stage door
interaction.
Do you do any impressions?
No.
What is your go-to album for a car trip?
For a road trip, probably Donna Summer, Greatest Hits.
Yes. One production show role you'll never get over not getting.
An angel in Kinky Boots.
Ugh. Worst audition you can remember?
In my life.
Ooh. Well, you may have dodged a bullet with that one.
So my agent didn't tell me that he had Tourette's, and apparently everyone else was warned, and I didn't know. And in the middle of my song, he started screaming, and I freaked out, and I have crazy anxiety. And loud noises, horns, and yelling shut me down emotionally.
Yeah.
I can't, like, my boyfriend gets so mad at me when people are screaming on the street, I lose all focus and I stop functioning because I fight or flight. And I stopped singing. I almost cried and I fled.
That's a story.
It's a bad audition.
Okay. I want blank to movie to be a musical.
Hocus Pocus.
If you could duet with Patti LuPone on one song, what would it be?
If I could duet with Patti LuPone on one song, WAP.
What is your favorite app?
My favorite app is Instagram.
What is your favorite Britney Spears song?
Breathe On Me.
And I know you can answer this, which most people cannot. Can you name two housewives?
Oh, God, yes. Erica Jane and Lisa Rinna, I guess.
Yeah, that's great. I'll do it.
A lot of housewives for you.
Can I tell you that at your episode 19 of this podcast, and only like two people have been able to name two housewives?
Well, it's also very recent for me. I've been immersed in housewife land.
It's a great hobby. Does anyone call you Martin?
One best friend from high school, her name is Kara. And really, that's it. I guess my brother calls me Martin Page.
Oh my God, I love it.
I was named after my grandfather's, and he calls me Martin Page.
Name a musical you're okay with never seeing again.
A musical, On Your Feet.
If you can go back in time. Hot Feet, different.
Different.
If you can go back in time and see any Broadway show, what would it be?
Oh, any Broadway show?
Yeah.
Original Lacage.
Ooh. Have you ever left a show at intermission?
No. Even for shows good. I really wanted to.
Good call. That is very impressive.
No, what movie, I always want to stick it up.
What movie can you watch over and over again?
Drop Dead Gorgeous.
If you can star on Broadway tonight in a show, what would it be?
Gosh, if I could star on Broadway in a show tonight, what would it be? Marty Thomas Live on Broadway from the Palace?
Yes. I love that. What a good way to end it, Marty. There are so many more things I wanted to talk to you about. You've had the most incredible career. You've done so much for the nightlife community in New York City, the gay community. Everybody loves you. There's no one in this business who doesn't know you and love you and follow you. So I'm so thankful that you are part of this today to share your kind of experience growing up on Broadway, which I think is just so interesting. And tell the people where they can find you and follow you and download your album and all that.
That was so kind, Mark. You can find me on Instagram at Marty Thomas Loves You, Marty with a Y. And you can find me on Twitter at Marty Thomas B-way, B-W-A-Y. And then my website, MartyThomas.com. I would love it if you would go find my album, Slow Dancing with a Boy, out on Broadway Records. It's on iTunes. You can find hard copies on the Broadway Records website, on my website. And of course, it's on Spotify and anywhere that music can be downloaded and streamed. I have two new albums coming out. So follow me and catch up.
Yeah, get on that Spotify and subscribe to Marty so you know everything he's doing. And remember to subscribe to me at Mark Tumanelli on Instagram, but also remember to follow the Little Me Podcast at Little Me Podcast. We'll be back next week with an all-new episode. Marty, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it so much.
You're the best. Thank you, listeners. This podcast is produced by Alan Seals, Dori Berenstein, and the Broadway Podcast Network, and edited by Derek Gunther. For more information on the Little Me podcast, go to bpn.fm/littleme. And follow me on Instagram at Mark Tumanelli or on Twitter at ThatTumanelli. And for more information on workshops, classes, and everything Broadway Workshop, go to BroadwayWorkshop.com. Thank you for listening.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com and, of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.